is the Past Lives Podcast, episode 246, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. My mission here at the Past Lives Podcast is to investigate evidence that demonstrates survival of the human soul. We will look at past life memories, near-death experiences, spirit communication, and other incredible phenomena. And please look out for the Past Lives Podcast episodes called Paranormal Stories, and they're released every Thursday. And if you want to hear the extended version of this episode, you'd need to sign up to the Patreon campaign. This week I'm talking to Claire Goodchild about her book, The Book of Seances, A Guide to Divination and Speaking to Spirits. Claire designed the Antique Anatomy Tarot, which quickly became a staple of the indie market, and is now mass market by Quattro. Claire then designed many more oracle decks, such as the Arcana of Astrology, the first astrology-based deck on the market, the Compendium of Constellations, the Oracle of Oddities, and her newest creation, Memento Mori. She's had her work featured in many publications, including Flair Magazine, American Express, BT Toronto, Refinery 29, Urban Outfitters, and Candice UK. In 2016, she was the recipient of the Etsy Canada Award for the Paper and Illustration category. Hey Claire, thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to be talking about your book, which is The Book of Seances, A Guide to Divination and Speaking to Spirits. Have you had a long-term interest in seances?
Yeah, so it's kind of split into two groups. I have been interested in the paranormal since I was a little kid, and I've been interested in divination since I was about 20 years old. And so it only felt natural to kind of marry the two eventually.
And so you had a paranormal experience when you were quite young. And it is one of those things, I think, you know, some people will say, well, I'll believe it when I see it, but you did see it. So you do kind of believe it.
Definitely. Yeah. I think that's the case for most people who believe in the paranormal, you know, like it's born out of some sort of experience. And very rarely do people who believe become skeptics, whereas skeptics will sometimes become believers. But yeah, when you're a kid, right, and you have an experience like this, you don't know how much actually really happened. You can only go based on how it felt for you. And for me, it felt very real. So that's, you know, the lens I have to take out into the world and see everything through.
Yeah. So what happened there?
So I was at my grandparents' house with my sisters, and, you know, we spent a lot of time there growing up, and we were playing a game in the living room or sitting room, and we were playing with this clown doll I had gotten from a friend, and we were pretending it had a heart attack, which is weird. Like, that's not something we did. You know, we didn't have any experience with medical professionals or those types of scenarios. So while we were pretending that this little doll was having a heart attack, my grandfather was actually having a heart attack and a stroke in his garage, just, you know, 200 feet or so from the house. And when it was discovered that he had died there, the paramedics came and they tried to revive him. And I had just before that said that the doll was not going to make it. And my grandfather died, and we never found the doll after that. Like, no one knows what happened to it. And my grandmother is one of those very organized type people. So it was really weird. And, you know, it kind of felt like some unconscious influence, you know, taking over, like just acting out what was happening, but not actually knowing. And that kind of led me to question all of these things, you know? So it's just been, it definitely changed the direction of my life, let's say.
Yeah, it's strange that it would be such a coincidence, not typical play for what you would be doing.
Right. Yeah, it's not something it's just not something, you know, in character, like none of us have an interest in that sort of field. And yeah, it was really weird and out of character and traumatic, obviously, but also in a way special too, which sounds really weird to say, you know, but it was.
Have you had other paranormal experiences going through life?
Yeah. So after my grandfather died, I would sometimes wake up at my grandparents' house and I would see him writing over his desk, which was in the room that I slept in. And I'd also see him around the property or see things out of the corner of my eyes. And, you know, with the seeing him at night thing, like, you got to wonder, was I just dreaming? And that was a way for me to process, you know, the trauma as a child, or was it something really happening? I don't think I'll ever know, but I like to think it was actually him. Maybe a residual haunting, not necessarily, you know, a conscious apparition. Yeah, just little things, you know, over the years, sounds, voices, images, like all kinds of crazy coincidences. None of them bad. I don't think I can really say I've had a negative experience, which is nice. I think a lot of people, their first one is one that kind of unsettles them. And yeah, I'm lucky in that way that, you know, there's been trauma connected to ghosts and spirits for me, but not anything that scared me away from it.
When you saw your grandfather, was he transparent? You know, that's that idea that ghosts will be transparent. Or did it look like he was actually there?
It looked like he was actually there. But in my mind, I kind of think of it as a kind of fuzzy outline. You know, like when a camera is just slightly off focus and it looks soft. It was kind of like that. But if it wasn't something you were thinking about, you wouldn't have noticed.
You also say in the book that you have a healthy dose of skepticism towards all things paranormal. So does that mean like you've got a BS meter?
Yeah, I think skepticism is really important when it comes to the paranormal, just because, you know, we can't just believe something strictly because we've been told to. And we also have to apply that sort of scrutiny to what we're seeing ourselves, especially as adults. And I think it's unrealistic to put that on children, right? Like, you can't expect them to sit there and run through a criteria of, oh, is what I'm seeing real? It's just real, right? But as adults, I think it's important to question everything in regards to the paranormal, just, you know, for yourself. And the level of skepticism is going to be really personal, right? Like, some people will say they have no skepticism at all, but others are like, yeah, I'm pretty skeptical, but I'm open to it. And then everyone else kind of falls in the middle, you know?
And there are some people who are just, their mind is completely closed, no matter what you say.
That's very true. Although I often, you know, it's funny because skeptics are sometimes never open to the paranormal and believing, but people who do believe are always open to a little bit of skepticism. And I think that's kind of special. You know, it makes believers a little more open-minded.
You might hear things like years ago and your skepticism would have kicked in. You thought, oh no, I can't, I go with that. That's madness. But as the years gone by, would you hear other things and then think, hang on a second, that thing that I heard about years ago, maybe I shouldn't be so skeptical about it.
Yeah, I think there are instances where that's happened for me, like trying to think of some, like once I had a friend who I just had this really weird feeling that, you know, they had a message from a grandparent. And so I told her and she's like, no, that's absolutely not true or whatever. And then later she came and was like, hey, so you remember that thing you told me? It turns out it was true. So it's generally been with other people, not so much me. It's kind of hard to change your mind all the time, you know, but I think you make a good point, like that we should go back and reflect on what we've seen and maybe it feels more real to us when we look back and maybe it doesn't.
Yeah, maybe when you gain more knowledge and you investigate more and then the puzzle pieces start coming together and then that thing back then makes more sense. Yeah. You talk about like the history of seances in the book. And can you tell us about the Fox sisters?
Yeah. So the Fox sisters were two girls from New York. Actually, they were originally from Canada and the family moved to New York. And these girls started hearing these knocking sounds, right? And it's our first real recorded or talked about instance of spirit rappings. And the family was like plagued by these knockings. And it kind of, they eventually like decided that it was a sort of alphabet, you know, one knock for A, two knocks for B, and so on. And they kind of realized that it was a supposed peddler who had been murdered under the house, and it was communicating, and he had an affinity for the girls, and word got out to the surrounding towns, and people kind of went crazy for this, and they wanted to see these two girls, and they wanted to hear the knockings. And so their older sister, who didn't live with them anymore, I think her name's Leah Fish, she decided to kind of take them on tour around the USA and parts of Canada and, you know, all that stuff. And so a lot of people theorize that the Fox sisters were actually capable of making these kind of knocking sounds using their joints. So that was kind of the skeptical side. And then there were other believers who, you know, wanted messages and started experimenting with spirit knockings themselves. And this kind of subjected the girls to some pretty brutal treatment, especially by men of the community. Like, they would be physically searched. And, you know, these were children. Like, they were, I think it began when they were 9 and 11. So you can only imagine being taken on tour and being made to perform, whether it was an actual spirit or not, right? And then having your body searched by doctors and random men and women just to see if you're faking or not. And, you know, years and years later, after the spiritualism movement kicked off, one of the sisters, I believe it was Maggie, she came out and said that she had faked them, you know, at an event. And a lot of people were really hypercritical of her confession because she was at this point a pretty severe alcoholic, and the event had been paid. They paid her a fee. She had no money. And she ended up recounting that statement a year later to say that it actually was real and it was a spirit. Whether you believe, you know, the Fox sisters or not, they really did begin the whole phenomenon of spirit communication for the average person, you know, in their home. So they're very interesting, yeah. You know. You can't really write a book about seances without talking about them. It just happened at, you know, a time when people were starting to really show an interest in all this stuff.
So basically, what is a seance? I get the impression that actually it's not just one thing.
Right. So I like to describe a seance as any deliberate communication with the dead. So we kind of do seances every day, right? Like, I know I talk to like my grandfather just out loud, and that's technically a seance. But what most people think about is a type of seance known as a table turning seance. And that is a group of people who sit around a table and it's led by a medium and messages are channeled through that medium for the viewers. And then that type of seance led to what is known as a stage seance, which is like the, you know, cold reading style seance, like where you're in a big audience and the psychic or medium says like, I have a J name. And then, you know, they kind of read off of you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So those are the two main types. But when table turning seances got really, really popular, people were like, you know what? I want to try doing this myself. And that's when you start to see tarot cards being used for spirit communication and not just for divination, which is kind of predictions and telling the future. And you also see like the average person doing automatic writing or using spirit boards. They were invented around this time. So seances really is an all-encompassing thing. But the way we kind of perform them today, whether with a medium or in a group or by ourselves, was born in this period surrounding the Fox sisters in the 1800s.
And what do you make of this thing of, is it table tipping, where the table just starts to move?
Yeah. So when seances and spiritualism got more popular, mediums kind of had to resort to more tricks to get the clients because there was so much competition. And they could do amazing things, these, I like to call them performers, because even if they were legitimate mediums, they were also performers. And, you know, they could move objects, they could even regurgitate cheesecloth and call it ectoplasm, things like that. I generally don't believe in that type of seance, which sounds weird, you know, considering I wrote a book on it and it's all about performing seances. But I think people conducting their own is more of a legitimate, meaningful activity, so to speak.
Okay, so if you were to go to a physical mediumship seance, mm-hmm. where these mm-hmm. physical things are happening in the room, you yeah. feel that some of it could be real and some of it's faked? Or is it?
Yeah, I think there are legitimate mediums, like, you know, having experienced stuff like that myself, I can't really say that someone else isn't real, right? But, you know, you still need to be careful. You need to figure out the difference between like cold reading and you know, legitimate messages, which can be hard because, you know, a lot of people go to these when they're in the middle of mourning, right? So you're already vulnerable. So yeah, I believe them and I don't believe them. And that's where that skepticism comes in for me.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's good because I talked to a physical medium called Stuart Alexander. Mm-hmm. It bothers him when people leave their critical analysis at the door when they come in and they just accept everything that happens. He says he wants people to challenge him and he wants people to look at it and try and examine it and see if there's a problem there. And that's what you've got to do, haven't you? You can't just think, oh, yeah, it's all real and not question anything.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with that. And even if, you know, you walk away from a seance and you don't think it was real and all that, I think you can still find something meaningful in the messages you got. You know, usually they're very supportive messages, right? So there's always something that you can take away with you that is a positive.
One thing you say in the book is that the terms ghosts and spirits are often used interchangeably, but there is a distinction between them. So what is that?
Yeah, so I actually use them interchangeably too. You know, a lot of people really do, don't they? So a spirit is the animating force of all things. It exists in both the state of life and the state of death. So what I mean by this is I could be described as a shy spirit, you know, like my demeanor, my character is shy or whatever. And then that kind of character or personality or animating force, you know, transfers into the state of death. So when you die, that part lives on. And then a ghost is the sensory manifestation of the spirit of a deceased person. So, you know, it's that my personal spirit coming back and being physically in the space. It's usually in the form of an apparition. But it can be sounds too. And, you know, ghosts fall under that. But yeah, I think it's okay to use them interchangeably. Like, you know, I don't think there's really a hard and fast rule about it.
Hello listeners, this is Simon. Now, as some of you know, I have a diploma in clinical hypnotherapy and I'm certified in past life regression therapy. And in the past few weeks, I've taken many clients through some amazing and healing past life regressions. And I conduct sessions over Zoom and I've had clients from many countries around the world. Now, when you go through a past life regression, you will feel totally in control and remember everything. And also, I record the whole session and send you an MP3 afterwards. And this gives you space to relax and go with the flow, knowing that you can listen back later and analyse what you experienced if you need to. So if you ever wanted to explore your past lives in a single session or have an issue you want to work on, you can go to my website at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk and book a free 20-minute consultation. And at the moment, I'm offering a 25% discount to everyone that has signed up to the Patreon campaign. The link is in the show notes. And so you say there are four main subgroups with ghosts and spirits: intelligent, residual, psychokinetic, and non-human. Could we go through each one? Or maybe you could say, if one of them's intelligent and one of them's residual, what's the difference?
So an intelligent ghost or haunting spirit is the conscious interaction between a spirit and the living. So that is kind of where the spirit knows what's going on and the living person or environment knows what's going on. Whereas a residual is the energy that's kind of imprinted on an environment. So it's not a conscious apparition or spirit or, a conversation, so to speak. It's rather a scene that plays on a loop, kind of like a movie. And it's always the same. And a lot of paranormal researchers theorize that maybe watery environments or places with lots of stone record this energy. And that's why, residual hauntings happen. And then psychokinetic, a lot of people would know the word poltergeist, which is a psychokinetic haunting. And that it's not actually a ghost or spirit. It's thought to be the manifestation of energy from a living person. Usually girls, going through puberty, which is kind of interesting. I don't know how much of that is, a social kind of sexist thing or not. And then non-human, that's your demons, your land spirits, elementals, things like that.
And so when you say non-human, you don't mean aliens.
You could. I think they would fall under that, in that category too.
And earlier you said that you thought when you saw your grandfather, that was residual.
Yeah. I don't think he was consciously there. I think his energy was just kind of stuck, on the environment. And, the only question that brings me is why do these hauntings only happen after death, right? Why do we not see them when the person's still living?
And what triggers them? I mean, if it was you that saw him, did anybody in your family see him? Or was it just you?
Just me. It almost makes you think, was that my energy projecting, this thing to happen? Residual hauntings are interesting like that. But then I also think, is that how we get doppelgangers, right? people swear they see their friend Joe walking down the street, but Joe's at work. Maybe it does happen with the living person. We just don't notice it as much because, they're alive. So we expect to see them.
It's fascinating. It's that idea of how it could happen, that this energy is imprinted on reality. It's stuck in a location though, isn't it? You wouldn't see your grandfather anywhere else.
It's so strange. I've never seen him, outside of that environment. It's weird, isn't it? I wonder also maybe what triggers a residual haunting could be the emotion, that kind of plays out and seeps out into the environment, I don't think it's something we're going to figure out anytime soon, but it's nice to think about.
Maybe it's because you've got some kind of mediumship or psychic talent that's just mm-hmm. built into you, a fundamental thing, and that has to be there to make the connection to trigger the residual recording to play.
I like that. I like that idea. Yeah, that's a good one. I think I'm gonna borrow that.
You also talk about your search for your great-great-grandparents' grave, and that was a fascinating yes. story. Could you tell us that?
Yeah, so to understand this story a little bit, you need to know about one of the oracle decks that I create. I have one called the Memento Mori Oracle, and it is kind of centered all around death and spirits and things like that. So I had I discovered that my paternal ancestors were located in a graveyard not too far from me. So I decided I wanted to go visit them. So I wrote down all the plot numbers and, you know, got all that stuff, went to the cemetery, and I couldn't find two of the headstones anywhere. Like, I got to their section and it was just grass. And I'm like, okay, great. Obviously, this is an older part of the cemetery. Maybe it's stuff's getting repaired. I'm going to have to replace this headstone. And I still wanted to kind of know the approximate area, you know, where they were buried, because it was quite a big section of the cemetery and broken up into probably 20 subplots. And I wanted to know where their plot was, because the, you know, markers are only approximate. And so I took out this deck and I shuffled and two cards fell on the ground. And when I looked at them, it was the grave card and the shovel card. And I was like, oh, you cannot be serious. You know, I'm not going to dig for you, because that's what I thought they were implying. But I decided to kick away a bit of the grass just to, like, you know, check. And their headstone, you know, the corner of it appeared. And so I pulled the rest of the dirt back, and there were their names completely grown over. And these two cards had fallen, you know, on this 1 foot by 1 foot spot in this large section of the cemetery. So to me, that, you know, is an intelligent haunting. The communication between us, both parties knew, you know, what I was asking, and they were giving me a response.
It's just remarkable. And there's so many people who might write it off, but it makes so much sense. And particularly what was on the cards, the shovel and the...
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, even if it was a coincidence, it's a happy coincidence, right? Later, when I got home, I decided to ask, I had gotten two more cards when I was there, and it was Plague Doctor and Smoke. And when I got home, I'm like, that's weird. I'm going to do more research on them. And it turns out they had both died of pneumonia. And if you think about smoke, it kind of affects your breathing and your lungs, and so does pneumonia. And Plague Doctor, you know, is an illness. So that was interesting too. And I know people will take that more, you know, with a grain of salt, but I think that's the great thing about spirit communication and working with spirits. It's personal. Like, when I stopped caring what other people thought about my interactions, that's kind of when they became more powerful and meaningful and important to me.
Yeah, that's the thing about it. I hear people talking about signs from the other side, and they can be so subtle sometimes. But when you get one, there's a certain feeling to it that's different. Mm-hmm. And that's where it's personal and it's emotional, and it's not that you can analyze it with logic.
Right. Yeah, especially if it's something recent too, you know, when you've lost someone and it's all fresh, and then you get a sign and you're just like blown away. Maybe looking back later, you're like, maybe that was just me being hopeful and sad. Or maybe you're like, no, this was 100% a sign from them. And that's something you get to carry, and it's yours. No one can take it from you, which I think is really great.
There's a part of the book that's called Why Hold a Seance? And you go over these different reasons. Should we go over those?
Yeah. So usually what I like to recommend to people is have a list of why you want to communicate with the dead. And people always, you know, have to really think about it. You know, when you ask them, like, why should I hold a seance? And there are so many reasons. There are so many reasons that, like, I can't even cover. But generally, the main ones are it can give you closure. You can be just curious to see if spirit communication works. You know, it can help solve family mysteries or things like that. I don't think the reasons need to be these huge, profound, you know, even important things. I think it's okay to do things because you're curious about it. And seances are a good way to kind of explore the other side a little bit. You know what I mean? Instead of going on a full-blown paranormal investigation to like a scary location, you can kind of play with it by yourself and kind of see what your comfort level is. And yeah, just having a list of reasons is a good thing.
And is there anything you would point out specifically and say, if you're trying to do this in a seance, then just don't do it?
Yeah, I don't believe that people should engage with like abusive people, you know. I like to think that the other side is a pretty happy, chill place, but you know, abusive humans exist in life and therefore they will exist in death too. So that's generally my one recommendation is, yeah, don't contact abusers, don't, you know, contact murderers, things like that. Like just use common sense, you know?
And some people say that you shouldn't use a Ouija board because it's just like you're just inviting everything in. Is there a way you can use it that's more controlled?
So, yeah, Ouija boards are quite a triggering topic for a lot of people, just because there's been so many stories and rumors about them. I can say pretty confidently that Ouija boards are perfectly safe, although I'm sure you have listeners who are like, no, I had a horrible experience. That's not me discounting your experience. I think anyone can have a bad experience, just like anyone can have a positive experience. But a lot of the negativity surrounding Ouija boards is a result of the satanic panic and, you know, rumors from the Catholic Church in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, kind of a backlash to people being more spiritual and leaving the church. And, you know, if people can communicate with spirits on their own, they can probably also communicate with God on their own. And the church doesn't really like that. So I think when it comes to a Ouija board, number one, there's no rule that says you have to use it. I don't want anyone to think like, oh, I put it in my book and now you have to use it. That's not true. If anything makes you uncomfortable, don't use it because you should always be comfortable when communicating with spirits. But I think also the second thing is educate yourself on the history of the Ouija board. And you're probably going to be a lot more comfortable once you realize how it was invented and, you know, things like that. And it's just a tool like anything else, like tarot cards, automatic writing. It's just another tool.
Was it invented by a games company? Is that right?
Yeah. So there are a lot of theories about why they decided to patent it as a game. And my theory is that they were obviously capitalizing on the spiritualism movement around that time in the 1890s. But with patents, you have to prove that it works. So it's kind of easier to prove a game works than it is to prove ghosts are real. So that's why I believe they patented it that way. But yeah, they were a game company, and the original creators eventually left the company and it was handed to one of their workers, William Fold. And he was so passionate about the Ouija board, like so passionate. It was the love of his life. It caused family feuds. It he created all kinds of different products, you know, Ouija perfume and all these strange things. And then eventually it was sold to Hasbro. And it's kind of been marketed as a game ever since, even more so than in the 1890s and early 1900s.
We did the Ouija board when I was like 17 or 18 years old. Mm-hmm. All these letters were coming through and it seemed mm-hmm. to be genuine. And somebody was writing them down and it just wasn't making sense. It just wasn't English. It seemed just nonsense. But there was a guy who, he was not at the Ouija board. He was the other side of the room and he was looking at what was written down. And he said, no, that's German language. And the thing is, his mum was German and he learned to read and write German. So he knew, but he was not on the Ouija board and nobody on the Ouija board knew how to write German.
That's wild. Well,
yeah, that was an interesting evening.
Was there more things that night? Like, you know, or just that message?
There was other things that night, but it didn't seem much. Just saying yes and no. And then there was a lot of swear words that came through.
Yeah. I wonder if you can chalk that up to being, you know, teenagers. I like to think that like when I'm a spirit that I'm going to mess with teenagers playing with Ouija boards too. So, I mean, I think that would be fun, but then I'd also be perpetuating more of these negative views about the Ouija board, which I also don't want to do.
There's something in the book that you talk about creating a sacred space. What does that mean?
So because I am a practicing witch, a lot of what you do in witchcraft is centered around having a kind of area that you feel comfortable in. And that is a sacred space. So a lot of people, when they think of a sacred space, they think of church or, you know, some other environment like that. But I believe you can make your own. And so that's what I mean by that. It's creating an environment where you're protected. It feels spiritual to you. And you can, you know, outline the boundaries in it, if that makes sense.
It's something to do with layering, isn't it?
Yes, yes. So I like to think when you make your sacred space that you want to bring in some sort of spiritual protection. And I like to do what is called layering. So in order for you to understand layering, I'm going to use an analogy about a front door. So your door keeps intruders out. But if you want to add a little more protection and ability to keep them out further, you add a lock, right? You want to do something more, you add a security system or a dog. You know, all those things are working together to keep you safe. So you can do the same with your sacred space and your seance space. Usually that involves things like lucky charms, right? Some people have something they carry around for good luck or protection. Some people are comforted by reciting scripture, things like that. You just want to bring in elements that make you feel spiritually comfortable and protected and have them in layers. So if one kind of isn't working enough, then you have some backups around.
And if you don't have those, have you heard of sort of negative after effects? So people have a seance and then the next day they start noticing poltergeist activity or something? Or am I getting too Hollywood now?
No, I've heard of them. But generally that comes back to like, you know, the common sense thing where like generally people go into something half cocked and they didn't quite understand what they were doing and they didn't want to put in the work of learning the history of, you know, the items they were using, things like that. I don't think it is as common as people say it is. Like, you know, if that was true, if negativity was happening all the time from the spirit world, we'd kind of have a bit of a situation, wouldn't we? Like, so I think most people, as long as they go into something having educated themselves and being respectful and you know, only contacting people who have your best interests at heart, right? You're going to be fine.
So can you tell us about automatic writing? I was interested to read about, is it Frederick Bly Bond and what happened with him?
Yeah. So his name is so hard to say, so I'm just going to call him Bond. So Bond was an architect, and he was commissioned to find Glastonbury Abbey. Glastonbury Abbey? Am I saying that right?
Yeah.
I think so. And, you know, he did end up finding the location of some imprints left by the original structure of the abbey. And that was all great. And, you know, he became really important, got more jobs. The church was really happy that he found this abbey. And then he was like, hey, I want to tell you all about how I found this abbey. And they're like, well, you're an archaeologist, an architect, you know, you're a talented guy. And he's like, well, actually, a friend of mine and I discovered it through the act of automatic writing. So Bond said that there was a spirit of a monk who once lived at the abbey who wrote out, you know, through Bond and his friend, whose name is escaping me right now, unfortunately, the location of where everything was. And, you know, it was accurate. So I think that's one pretty significant instance of automatic writing, you know, kind of being proven in a way. No one else had been able to find it, but he did. But then, you know, there's that skeptic side of, well, you know, he was an archaeologist. He was highly intelligent. He was a, you know, a pretty well-rounded guy. So maybe he just intuitively knew and writing was a way for him to get it out. But either way, he found it. And that's really, really cool. The church wasn't so happy. They ended up stripping him of all his ceremonial stuff they had given him and pretty much telling him not to come back.
And there was a lot of people involved in like spiritualism and the College of Psychic Studies.
Mm-hmm.
The Society for Psychical Research, wasn't it? Was it Arthur Conan Doyle was involved, and was Thomas Edison involved?
Yeah, so spiritualism was so big that everyone was into it. And I don't know if I actually defined this at the beginning of the episode, but spiritualism is the belief held by a group of people that the consciousness continues on after death. And they were the ones who would hold seances and things like that. So the average person and the, you know, celebrities of the day were into it too. Like everyone was into spiritualism and seances and speaking to ghosts. And, you know, like you said, Conan Doyle, Edison, even Alexander Graham Bell. People were crazy for it. Like to them, it made as much sense as science did. Today, we're so they're such opposing forces, you know, but a lot of the scientific kind of research that really propelled us as a group of people was born out of this time too. And it's because I think people were more open-minded and they experimented and, you know, Edison wanted to prove that ghosts were real. And, you know, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, he did automatic writing and he was more interested in the, you know, emotional and artistic side, but one was not considered better than the other, right? No one looked down on one another, except for one magician who kind of made a career out of debunking mediums, but that's kind of a different story.
And was it Edison tried to invent a spirit phone?
I haven't found like a lot of confirmation about this, but it is believed that he was trying to build a device that could communicate with the dead. And Alexander Graham Bell actually invented the phone based on his belief in the other side. He had a pact with his brother that whoever died first would contact the other. And unfortunately, his brother died pretty young. And so he started working on this machine that could talk to his brother and eventually led to the phone, which is really cool, right? Something we take so for granted now. And, you know, it was born out of this interesting idea of an afterlife.
So getting back to automatic writing, do you feel mm-hmm. that anybody could do it?
Yeah. I think anyone can do any type of divination and spirit communication. I think automatic writing is the best one to start with because, number one, it's accessible. So in your house, there's a good chance you have a piece of paper and a pen, you know, so you don't have to go and buy anything special. And it's also the main type of divination that was popular by mediums during this time. So you're kind of connecting to that history and you know, all the people before you who were trying this out too. And I kind of think those connections can make you more sensitive in a way. But yeah, automatic writing is just channeling a spirit's messages through you and onto paper. And it's kind of a practice where you really have to be able to balance that believer side of you and skeptic side of you, you know, like, because when you're doing it, you might come up with like, oh, I'm just thinking about this and, you know, it's really me. It's not a spirit kind of thing. So yeah, learning to marry the two ideas and also figure out, you know, what messages you are going to believe that you've written out and which ones you aren't. That's the tricky part. It takes practice.
Yeah, I suppose you have to sit down with the pen and paper, is it? And you just almost like go into a meditation and clear your mind and just allow something to come through. But I would imagine you'd have to keep trying a lot before something would come through.
Yeah, I think it really depends on the person. Like that is not something that comes overly natural for me. It does now that I've practiced it for a long time, but yeah, it, you know, some people are going to take to it right away and are going to feel messages right away. And others are going to be like, oh, it's been 3 months. I haven't gotten a single thing. So it really depends on the way your brain works, I think, you know, like, even though I'm an artist, I'm not really a creative person, which sounds really weird to say, but like things that require more intuition, I'm not strong at. But, you know, that doesn't mean that if you're like that, you can't get better at it.
Yeah. Yeah. So much stuff takes practice, doesn't it? It's like mm-hmm. playing the guitar or something. You can't be an expert immediately.
Exactly. Yeah. I think a lot of people go into using these tools and they're like, oh, I didn't get something the first time, so it doesn't work and I'm not doing it again. Which I think is kind of a shame because if you stick with it, you know, you're going to figure out how it works. Your routine, the routine of the spirits, you know, you need a couple sessions before you kind of develop a pattern or learn to see what you're, you know, to see the answers or depending on what you're using. I think with automatic writing in particular, people do kind of have an innate connection towards it. Like, you know, when you're doodling and you don't realize that you've like written things or drawn things, it's the same idea. We don't always know where that comes from, right? Like we might look down at the paper and be like, oh my God, that's weird. Why did I write that word? Or why did I draw that flower kind of thing? So you just have to get into that headspace. And once you do, you're going to be a lot more successful.
So there's a sentence in the book which kind of stood out to mm-hmm. me. It said, communion with the spirits lies at the crossroads of spirituality and science. And what did you mean by that?
So like I was saying earlier with how, you know, you had the world's brightest minds kind of believing in spiritualism and science at the same time. You know, it's really that balance between faith and skepticism, and that's the crossroad. Like, your personal, you know, line on or spot on that spectrum, right? I think we can combine spiritual tools with, you know, physical scientific tools, like the way paranormal investigators generally do. Yeah, that's all I mean about that. It's just finding your own personal level of belief and how you want to work with things, and, you know, what are you going to implement to make sure that your seances are well-rounded. And, you know, for some people that's all divination tools and spiritual tools, and for other people that's just, you know, EVP recorders and EMF readers and things. So I think finding that middle ground.
Okay, so that would kind of be a scientific seance when you're using that equipment.
Yes.
And so in all your research, what's the most remarkable thing you've heard about happening in a seance?
Ooh, most remarkable thing. This is a tough one because, okay, you know, there are so many great stories. You know, it's not so much, I think what amazed me most just happened to be, you know, how involved people were, you know, in the practice of seances. You know, I love the story about Bly Bond and the story about Alexander Graham Bell. But at the end of the day, I think the most impactful thing for me was just that we pretty much had the whole Western world all participating in something, you know, and I think that's made it super powerful and special. And if I had to pick, I think the Bly Bond story is the one that really impressed me. You know, like, how often do you find the outline of ruins with automatic writing? You know, that doesn't happen every day.
You have some exercises in the book as well, don't you? You are like a clairaudience exercise, clairsentience mm-hmm. exercise. So can you tell us about them, how people should approach doing that?
Yeah, so a lot of people, when they start getting interested in seances, spirit communication, what have you, they're like, well, I wasn't born with any special ability and therefore I can't do it, which I very much disagree with. I think everyone is capable of mediumship and everyone has psychic abilities. And I think it's, some people are just born with those more developed. Like, if you think about a professional athlete, so we all have muscles, but their muscles are, you know, a little bit more in tune with, you know, being athletic, right? It doesn't mean that the average person can't get better at it. Will they ever be as great as a long distance runner? Maybe not, but that's fine, right? So you can kind of strengthen your innate abilities by doing small exercises. And, you know, a lot of people think that it's going to take a lot of effort, and the effort really just comes in with being consistent with these exercises. They don't have to be grand or over the top, but you do need to be consistent with it. So my favorite is when you want to develop your kind of clairsentient and that's like your universal knowing kind of sense, you know, where you just know something. So you take a bunch of cups, not clear ones, so like mugs are really good for this, and you have someone put different coins in each cup and then cover them, and then you practice, guessing, I guess is the right word, which coin is in which cup. And you practice this over and over and over and over until, you know, you're confident that you're listening to your intuition, because that's really the goal of these exercises. It's not that it's improving your psychic abilities. It's that it's teaching you to trust yourself. Another one for clairaudience, which is psychic hearing, is listening to a song and picking out a word. So it could be any word. Let's say the word is, I don't know, peanut butter. And then throughout the day, you see how often you come across, you know, the word peanut butter, whether you hear it, see it, doesn't matter. And that's just to teach you to be more aware of your surroundings. It's not that suddenly you're getting all these messages and signs. You're just learning to trust yourself.
Yeah.
I hope that made sense. Like it's easier to kind of read them out step by step, but the gist is, you know, by developing these skills, it's about developing the relationship with yourself.
Like you say, with the coins in the cups, it's not like you're really seeking out the coins. You're seeking out your ability to determine what is correct and what isn't.
Exactly. Yeah. It's about, you know, a lot of people second guess themselves, right? So you might be like, oh, that 5 cent coin is in the green mug. And you're like, but maybe it's in the blue mug. And then you uncover them and it's in the green mug. You know, like it's just about trusting your first response and your instincts.
It's been really great talking to you. I've really enjoyed the conversation. The book we've been talking about is The Book of Seances, A Guide to Divination and Speaking to Spirits. And that's on Amazon, isn't it? Is it everywhere?
It is. It's on Amazon. For your UK listeners, I'm not quite sure. For Canadians and Americans, it's on Indigo, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, all those big retailers.
And if somebody wanted to get a deck of your cards, can they do that with Amazon?
Yeah, so you can get the Antique Anatomy Tarot on Amazon. And for my Spirit Communication deck, you can get that through me at blackinthemoon.com.
Great. Well, thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
And that was an interview with Claire Goodchild about her book, The Book of Seances, A Guide to Divination and Speaking to Spirits. And if you want to hear the rest of this fascinating interview, you can sign up to Patreon. When you sign up for $5 a month, you get an extended episode every week. And for $2 a month, you get an extended episode every month. And the Patreon episodes are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. And please check out my other podcast. It's called the Alien UFO Podcast. And I release new episodes every Monday. And you can find it on almost every podcast app. And I've also added a new tier to the Past Lives Podcast Patreon campaign, where for $12.50 a month, you can get the Alien UFO Podcast extended episodes every week, as well as the Past Lives Podcast extended episodes. And including the Alien UFO Podcast episodes, there are now more than 100 extended episodes available in the back catalogue. You can become a patron by going to patreon.com/Past Lives Podcast, or click on the Patreon button on my homepage at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk, and the links are in the show notes. And look out for the Past Lives Podcast episodes called Paranormal Stories, and they're released every Thursday. And there is a Past Lives Podcast Facebook group. If you'd like to join, you'd be very welcome. And if you enjoy the podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening. I wanted to ask you about tassiography. Is that how you say it? And you had a connection with your nan through that. Is that right?
Yeah. So tassiography that's the right way to say it. Don't worry. But it can also be pronounced tassiography and tassiomancy. And that is the art of reading tea.